What's up, baseball fans? Welcome to the On the Bump podcast, where two current major league pitchers take a deep dive into an all-time great pitcher of the past. We got a fun one today. We got pitcher Jameson Taillon talking about Hall of Famer John Smoltz. Jameson Taillon, I call him J-Mo, as you'll hear me throughout this podcast, personally requested that we talk about Smoltz, so he's really ready to dive in. But you guys know I got to bore you a little bit with some background and some stats before we get into this conversation, so I'll bring J-Mo in here in a little bit. But I need you guys to really understand what made Smoltz so good and how he ended up in the Hall of Fame. So hang with me for a few minutes, and we'll get Jameson in here. So Smoltz was born in Detroit, drafted and signed with his hometown team, the Tigers, 22nd round out of high school. And then the Tigers just went on and traded him to Atlanta. Get this, that would start a 22-year career with the Braves. He was traded to Atlanta in 1987, still a minor leaguer. 22 years later, still a Brave. Debuts at 1988, 21 years old. Struggled a little bit as a rookie, but then rips off 9 really great seasons as a starter. Averages 220 innings a year. Just really something you don't see anymore. That's an incredible workload. But that workload catches up to him, and he has Tommy John surgery in 2000. So he misses the entire 2000 season, comes back. Legendary manager Bobby Cox says, "You know what, Smoltz, I don't think your elbow is built to be a starter anymore, man. We're going to move you to the bullpen. We're going to make you our closer." So all Smoltz does is go be the most dominant closer in the National League for 3.5 seasons, actually led the league in saves his second year as a closer with 55. That's still tied for the most in National League history. And he excelled so much as a closer that the Braves just, "You know what, we're going to move you back into the rotation." So they make him a starter again. And now this time all he does is go 200 innings for the next 3 years, including 205 as a 40-year-old man in 2007. That's Rich Hill vibes right there. Still throwing 200 innings as a 40-year-old man. So multiple times you heard Smoltz say stuff like, "I'm going to pitch until they rip the jersey off my back." And that's literally exactly what he did. He pitched until he was 42 years old, until his arm was basically about to fall off. So let's get into a little career accolades. He finished his career as the only pitcher in history to get 200 wins and 150 saves. That's incredible. One of 18 pitchers in history to eclipse 3,000 strikeouts. If you guys follow Major League Baseball, you know how elite of a group that is, the 3,000 strikeout group. It's a very rare feat in baseball. He did win the Cy Young in 1996. Keep in mind, he was competing with his teammates, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, as well as many other good pitchers in the National League at that time. So to win one in 96 is a huge accomplishment. You know, no doubt a Hall of Famer. You hear me rip off stats like that, you know he's a Hall of Famer. But what solidified him as a first ballot Hall of Famer is the postseason stuff. So the Braves won 14 straight NL East division titles during his career. 14 straight. So John Smoltz got plenty of opportunities to pitch in the postseason, and he took advantage of it. That's the hardest stage to pitch on in the world. And he did it 14 years in a row, basically. And he shined like a star, basically, every time he had a chance. So he's second all-time in postseason wins, third all-time in innings pitched. He's now third all-time in strikeouts, now that Clayton Kershaw passed him on this World Series run the Dodgers just went on. 15-4, four saves, 209 innings, and a 2.67 ERA in the postseason. So just incredible. Always had his best stuff when it mattered the most in the postseason, and part of those awesome Braves runs of the late 90s into the 2000s, and rightfully so, first ballot Hall of Famer. So now that we know a little bit about John Smoltz, let's bring in Jameson Taillon. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. It is bright and early before an off-season workout. I'm sitting here with Jameson Taillon. J-Mo, how you doing, man?
Doing well, yeah. Early Monday morning, leg day with old Ben Fairchild here.
All right, so a little background on J-Mo. Second overall pick by the Pirates in 2010. Still with the Pirates, one of the better young starting pitchers in the big leagues. Currently on his way back from his second Tommy John surgery. J-Mo, how's the second rehab going, man?
It's feeling good. I actually just yesterday got activated off the 60-day, so that felt good. Obviously, it's like a paper move, but it still feels good to consider myself healthy again. And I'm going into spring training healthy and ready to roll.
Yeah, it's a big step in the right direction, I remember. I was in the minor leagues at the time, but I kind of remember the same being like, all right, you're getting going. You're now like on a double-A roster. We're about to send you there. And it feels like things are finally in motion.
Yeah, it kind of feels like my rehab's now more done, and I'm shifting towards like my throwing and everything is building up towards next year instead of just rehabbing now, which was what all of 2020 felt like to me.
Yeah, so between you, me, and John Smoltz, there's four Tommy Johns between the three of us. So feels like we're talking about the right guy. Normally, we pick guys that kind of comp to each other. You know, we did Sandy and Clayton Kershaw. We did Trevor Bauer, Tim Lincecum. Guys that are, you know, you kind of see a little similar. I don't necessarily see a lot of John Smoltz in you, but you asked to do John Smoltz. What sticks out to him and why are we talking about him today?
Yeah, so I think the Braves pitching staff is one of the most interesting pitching staffs of all time. Watching Greg Maddux. Like when I was a kid, I was a power pitcher. I had good command. I threw strikes, but I was more like power fastball, power curveball. So I didn't have a lot in common with Greg Maddux. So I'd watch him and I'd enjoy it and respect it. But like, I wasn't learning a ton from watching him. And then you have Tom Glavine, who left-handed, obviously very different. And then he made his living on fooling hitters, alternating speeds, keeping them off balance. And again, enjoyed watching him, but didn't take a ton from it. So then you have Smoltz in there, who to me was like the most identifiable one with me. Power, fastball, curveball, slider. Yeah, I just enjoyed watching him. One of my best friends growing up was a huge Braves fan, so we watched a lot of Braves games. His house was like the sleepover house, so it was always Braves on weekends at his house.
Yeah, I didn't watch a ton of baseball growing up, really, man. Like, this kind of generation was like the last one that I missed. I didn't watch a lot of Maddux and Smoltz. So when I watched some video to prepare for this podcast, I didn't realize Smoltz was the power pitcher that he was that you just talked about. The Smoltz that I remember was like a 40-year-old man throwing like a bunch of curveball splitters and probably in the high 80s, low 90s. You know, you go back to those late 90s Smoltz, or even when he's a closer, I mean, he's bringing 95, 96, I think a couple times 98. He was definitely a power pitcher, and I didn't know that. So what... We both prepared for this podcast a little bit, and obviously you said you grew up kind of watching them. What do you remember kind of learning, studying them? You know, what'd you get out of watching them pitch?
I do remember, I think of him as a power guy. I don't know why. Maybe that's just because stacked up next to Maddux and Glavine, but I remember his slider. I remember his slider being so stinking good, and I remember him being one of the guys I was a little ahead of the times where, like, he threw his best pitch a lot, and I consider his slider, I guess, his best pitch, and he threw it a ton. And back then, it seemed like if you threw 95, you're a wuss if you don't challenge guys with your four seam. Well, he was out there, you know, throwing sliders behind in the counts, throwing 3-2 sliders at a time where that was a little more rare. So I always enjoyed that. And I saw you put a note here about him being able to control the break of his slider. And I can remember that so clearly. He would have, like, to righties and lefties, a totally different one. He would have a different 001 versus an 021. And I remember thinking that was really cool.
You're leading the podcast. You got ahead of me here. So agreed. When I watched this, it was like a 7-minute interview. He'd just been inducted in the Hall of Fame, and he's doing this interview talking about, oh yeah, I would just control the break. And I wouldn't tell my catcher. I would just do it. And the catcher, he knows it's going to break, so he's going to catch it. So I don't have to worry about telling him which one's coming, the smaller one, the harder one, the bigger one. And there's some guys that I've played with that can do it. Buehler can do it. Rich Hill can do it. I can't do it. I cannot, for one, I don't want to change my arm angle. And two, it's either I want to throw a slider or a curveball. I don't want to get into the middle or anything like that. So I want clear distinction between the slider and the curveball. And it sounded like he would throw hybrids, then he would throw like almost a cutter, then he'd throw a big breaker. I think you throw both a curveball and a slider, right? Do you mess around with the middle ground, or do you do like clear one or the other?
Yeah, so when I started throwing my slider, it was one of those things that I wanted it to be so separate from my curveball, because my curveball is like a big 80, 82 mile an hour curveball. I didn't want my slider to be like 84 and depthy and slurvy. So when I started throwing my slider, it was like 90, 92 and really cutter-ish. And then as I've gotten more comfortable with it, I can manipulate it a little bit, but I think more than anything, I'm just like dialing my slider back and making it more of a true like 87 mile an hour slider. But yeah, I can do it, but I don't think it works for me the way it would work for him. Like, I don't have the command of it as well. Like, yeah, like you said, switching arm angles, maybe your delivery messes up a little bit. So I try to just stick with one, and it can change on every different game.
Which I think is interesting to think about, because when I watch you pitch, I think you're pretty elite at spinning the ball. I consider myself really good at spinning the ball. I don't throw hard. My fastball is not my best pitch. My breakers are. So I consider myself a really good spinner of the baseball, yet I can't do this. So to think he must be that much more elite than us, and that's probably why he's in the Hall of Fame and we're sitting here talking about him.
Yeah, you know, I'm definitely like, my breaking balls are, they come naturally to me. Like, spinning the ball does come naturally, but I don't know. I guess he definitely has more repetitions with it too. He's had, you know, that long of a career throwing that many innings. He threw a ton of sliders, probably way more than I've thrown in my lifetime. So he has that feel.
Yeah, well, we're staring at it right here. So pitch arsenal, kind of the percentages. You guys are similar in about, you know, both throws four seam, two seam, sinker, whatever you want to call it, about the same amount. He threw 35% sliders. You throw about 32%. The difference is you mix in more curveballs. He mixes in more splitters. But the arsenal is fairly similar. And how we touched on earlier, he was a power pitcher and we didn't even know it. Tony Gwynn called him quote unquote overpowering, which is a big testament from Tony Gwynn. I feel like he would always say, like, yeah, that guy's not that bad. He's never punched me out. When you think about this arsenal, and you think about watching him pitch, The splitter is the one that stands out to me. And we did Tim Lincecum with Bauer. Like, that's a splitter I remember. Like, that's Tim Lincecum's splitter. Like, I don't remember John Smoltz's splitter, and he threw it 15% of the time, which is a pretty big number.
Yeah, there's not a ton of splitters I remember. And I remember Roger Clemens' splitter growing up. I don't remember Smoltz's quite as much, but 14%'s like, I mean, that's a solid number. Coming from a guy like me who just doesn't really throw a changeup, I don't understand how to throw a changeup. I've never figured out a grip that's comfortable to me. So, yeah, I don't remember him having that great of a splitter, but I guess it was there. And obviously, if you throw it 14% of the time and you're a Hall of Famer, that's an elite pitch, I would guess.
He's got the arsenal, right? He's got five pitches. He threw the curveball a little bit. And from now listening to him on some interviews prepping for this podcast, and now he just did the World Series. So listening to him in the broadcast booth, like, he's a smart dude. You can tell he knows what he's doing. He's kind of like Tony Romo in football. Like, he kind of will call stuff before it happens. I remember he called one of Seager's homers. He said, hey, if that guy throws it right there again, Seager's going to hit it out. And lo and behold, Seager went out dead center. So now you're talking about a five-pitch arsenal and a smart dude with this kind of stuff. I think it really stands out to me now. It's like, okay, this is why he was that good, because he's got the brains. He was also hanging out with Maddox and Glavine all the time. And now he's got this pitch arsenal. Like, okay, it makes sense why he was so good.
Yeah, that's something our starters talk about, is like, getting in a room with Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz, and they had some other great arms on that staff throughout the years. It's like, what were they talking about? What were they talking about that we're not talking about? You know, we watch each other's bullpens, we sit together in the dugout, but that's something we talk about a lot. It's like, what were they talking about on the golf course? What were their discussions like? Did they watch each other's bullpens? Because, I mean, that's a lot of, I guess, just talent and baseball knowledge in a room together.
Yeah, I actually wrote that down. So, because he had Glavine and Maddox, and then you came up with guys like Musgrove, Cool. I feel bad. I can't say it. Cool. Trevor Williams, Garrett Cole, even thrown in there.
Played with Glasnow in the minors too a little bit.
Yeah, you know, some really good young names there. And I got to think the competition between Smoltz, Glavine, Maddox, you know, probably brought the best out of all of them. And they're all winning Cy Young. Smoltz was able to sneak one in there in 96 with those guys. Kind of like college. Like, I remember I had Michael Wacha in college, and I always wanted to outpitch Wacha. Like, I wanted to keep up with him. And I imagine it was kind of the same for you guys. Like, you bring out the best in each other.
Yeah, I felt that probably even a little more in the minor leagues. We were all in AAA together trying to get called up, and we all knew what was at stake. And we were all just doing really, really well. We all had like sub 2.5 ERAs, and we were going 7 every outing. And that's when it's really fun, when you're just rolling off those starts. Obviously, in the big leagues, it gets a little harder. And we're kind of trying to help each other out. Meanwhile, we're trying to compete and, you know, pass the torch each night. But yeah, that's a cool feeling and a cool vibe when the starters can roll them off like that.
All right, let's get into the workload a little bit, man. I love looking at these old workloads and how many innings they threw and how long they played. It's just outrageous. I mean, we did the Sandy Koufax podcast. He had years where he had 300-something innings.
Insane.
You know, just outrageous. All right, so he threw over 200 innings 10 times. You threw 191 in 2018. So can you imagine basically doing that another 9 times in a row?
No. Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I threw 191 innings in 2018 and then came into 2019 and my elbow was on fire and I ended up getting surgery in 2019. So, I mean, that's incredible. I don't know what the exact number is of guys throwing 200 innings, you know, in a normal year, but the number is decreasing every single year. And to be able to do it, you know, every single year, that's incredible. We have a guy in our division, John Lester, who, like, I think he has some crazy stat of making 30 plus starts in 10 straight years. That's incredible to me.
Yeah.
You don't even roll an ankle while you're running.
Right. Like, yeah, there's some luck mixed in and you're just a grinder and you showed up to the next spring exhausted. Now imagine piling it on year after year. You know, the longevity that these guys had, I mean, it makes me think they're out there pitching at like 75% effort. I don't get it. So the 2 years that really blow my mind is, and we'll get into it, and I talked about it a little bit before I brought you in, was the postseason innings that he had. I mean, through another full season in the postseason, over 200 innings. So 96, 97, won the Cy Young in 96, 253 innings in the regular season, plus 38 postseason innings. So that's 291 in 96. Then 97, he goes 256 innings in the regular season, plus 15 in the postseason, 271. So in a span of two seasons, he went 562 innings. And that blew my.
That doesn't even sound real.
That's more than you and I's career, and that he did it in 2 years.
And I'm a guy, I've never pitched in the postseason, so I don't even know what that feels like to throw a complete year as a starter and then go into the playoffs and be asked to take the ball, sometimes on short rest, you know, on the biggest stage. So that's incredible.
Yeah. So he once again, in an interview, this is word for word from him, talking about how the postseason workload is actually what really takes a toll on you. He said one playoff inning is worth two regular season innings. He says that's a study that they've done, and he lives by it. So he threw another 200 innings in the playoffs, call that 400 innings on his body. You know, he said every postseason pitch feels like a regular season pitch with a runner on third and one out. Like, you're just doing everything you can to not let that guy score, no one on base. At 53 years old today, how do you think he's feeling following all that?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard Roger Clemens still throw his bullpens and stuff. I'd be curious if Smoltz plays catch still. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he's spending a lot of time on the golf course, but he looks pretty good to me. But yeah, I mean, that's a workload on your body, and throwing a baseball, it's so one-sided. Like, you never even it out and throw left-handed. So I'm sure he's got some, I'd be curious what his knees and low back and shoulders feel like and stuff, but that's just an incredible workload.
So you're a guy coming back off your second TJ. This one, you've really revamped some mechanics, especially the arm path. What's funny about Smoltz to me when I watch him is he does the inverted W. Now, he doesn't do it as big as like a Mark Pryor, but he definitely does the inverted W in a time when they thought that that was good for mechanics and a good arm path. And now we know it's about as bad of a thing as you can do. Yet he was like, he was able to stay healthy. Besides a Tommy John there right in the middle, what are some of the things you're focusing on your new mechanics? I've noticed it's a shorter arm path and all that kind of stuff. What's kind of the thought behind it?
With mechanics, it's interesting because you can study them all you want, and there's no clear-cut way to stay healthy or to throw harder. You know, it's different for every person. Some people's bodies can handle being in an inverted W and having a certain position, you know, be strong with their body. But for me, I just felt like my arm path was getting too long. I was externally rotating too fast, which was putting my elbow at risk, clearly, as evidenced by two Tommy John surgeries. So the big thing I went back to the drawing board with was my lower half and the way it works and moves. And, you know, you hear about like getting into your backside so often, and I didn't have a clue what that actually felt like until this rehab, which is kind of sad. But, you know, pitching coaches, you hear so many cliches like get the ball out on time or stay tall over your legs. But it's like, that might not be right for every single person. And there's research and evidence coming out that, like, you know, each pitcher is different and, you know, that cliche won't work for some and it might work for others. So I'm trying to focus on like a hip hinge movement to get into my glute, to get into my backside. And then by doing that and moving a little more efficiently with the lower body, my arm has like really shortened up. So when my front foot's planting and I'm at foot strike, I'm in a much healthier, cleaner position. There's not as much stress on my arm. You know, I worked up to four innings in simulated games, and I wasn't getting sore the day after. I was playing catch the next day. So the early feedback is really good. But I mean, to be honest, I saw like Giolito and I saw Shane Bieber and all these guys that were shortening up and, you know, making their starts and going deep into games. And I just started diving into it.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I don't think that I'll make the switch, but I tell you what, man, you watch guys like Giolito, Bieber, like you said, and you watch them down and away and then a slider right off the same path with that sand. It's like, I don't know how you hit it.
Yeah, for me, it was kind of just, it's fight or flight. Like, I've had two Tommy Johns, I'm 28. I don't have time to just, I don't know, go rehab and do the same thing over and over again. So I just decided to make a big change. And the people at Florida Baseball Ranch, you know, kind of went external from the organization there and worked with them. And now they're helping with my programming. And we got a new pitching coach who's really forward thinking with all this stuff. So he's been a huge help. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that's a perfect segue into kind of one of the things I want to talk about is it's about finding coaches that you trust, and coaches, when they get their hands on you and try and change it, that you trust that they're doing it for the right reasons, not to just put their stamp on you and that you think it's going to work for you. And one thing that's crazy about Smoltz is he literally had the same coach for like 20 something years, man. His name was Leo Mazzoni. Had him from AAA in the Braves all the way through almost every season in the big leagues. Can you imagine having that kind of consistency? Like, a Kershaw had Rick Honeycutt, and their relationship is something that was always just really special to watch and watch them work together and learn from each other and go back and forth. You know, and that was 10 years together, I think. Now double that. The amount of stuff and things they must have seen together and gone through together is just crazy. Can you imagine having, from the day you were drafted with the Pirates, now another decade past what you've already done, same guy with his hands on you every day?
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, their working relationship must have been incredible. I mean, they must have known how to communicate with each other so well. We just switched pitching coaches. The last guy, Ray Searidge, who I love, and he's a really great guy. He was more about like preparing you for a start through scouting reports, going over all the handwritten information from the advanced scouts. He was really big into kind of the non-mechanical aspect. I think his thinking was maybe a little more old school in the sense, like, when you get to the big leagues, you're a finished product. You should be ready to just game plan and go out and compete. And now our current pitching coach is all about continued development, continued learning. He, you know, if you see something in your mechanics that's getting off the beaten path, he's going to give you, prescribe you with a drill, maybe a weighted ball drill, or he's going to watch you play catch a little closer that day. He might do the core velocity belt with you or something. So it's really different. And for me, it's been cool to see how both sides work. But then if you have a good working relationship with one, I guess that'd be really cool to have them the whole time.
I mean, I can name 10 pitching coaches that I've worked with, yeah. You know, just from the Dodgers organization. Then you get into guys in the offseason and all sorts of stuff. You know, this, he had one the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, low A, high A, double A, triple A. You can have turnover at the big league level, pitching coordinators, rovers, like, that's crazy.
I think the idea of spending two decades with one organization is pretty cool and something that you don't really even hardly see in sports anymore. You know, thinking about even like a LeBron James, how good he is going to spend basically 6-7 years with three different organizations over the course of his career. You know, John Smoltz, from age 21 to 41 years old, he showed up to the same park every day. Just to have that kind of consistency is crazy. And to have that kind of fan base, like to know that I could buy my kid a John Smoltz jersey, yeah, and by the time he gets to college, he can still rock that to the Halloween party.
That's a good point.
Like,
yeah,
that's cool. It's just something you don't see anymore. Can you imagine 10 years from now still being a Pittsburgh Pirate? I mean, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually got a text from our bullpen coach who's been with the organization for a long time. He's worked his way up the ladder as a pitching coach. So we designated Davidas Navarauskas for assignment yesterday. And he texted me today and was like, hey, buddy, it's just you and me left now, because we were the longest tenured Pirates now after Davidas. So, I mean, that's only 10 years. And I texted him back and was like, dude, when I got drafted, I envisioned every kid I played with, every kid from my draft class, that we're all going to play together in the big leagues and we're going to retire Pirates. And that's just not the way the world works. That's not the way baseball works. But I've been in Pittsburgh now for maybe close to 5 years. And like, it is cool. Even just in 5 years, you start to get to know the security workers, the people in the garage, all the clubbies, obviously. You start getting to know even ticket sales and marketing department, and that kind of stuff's cool. So, I mean, you obviously have to be extremely good to stick around for 20 years, but even just in 5 years, like, you start to form relationships with the city and all the people, which is really cool.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I got traded from the Dodgers to the Blue Jays, and yeah, every text that you get from a coach or a player means a lot too, but I was getting texts from, you know, guys that in our marketing department, like you said, and people that I'd work with in the media, and just like saying, you know, nice things like that. That goes
a long
really
cool,
way.
Yeah.
And those relationships sometimes might last longer than the ones with your teammates,
yep,
you know, depending on who you're close with and what, you know, all the stuff that goes on in a locker room, man. So, all right, back to John Smoltz a little bit. So I wrote this down in an era of openers, starting pitchers that go two innings and get pulled, maybe just go one time through the lineup or five and dive. I wrote that John Smoltz is technically the best hybrid pitcher that's ever lived.
Yeah.
He started and he killed it, and he had a Tommy John. And then at age 35, so I'm 31, I'll be 31 going into the season, JMO 28. At 35, he switched to be a closer. Most guys at 35 don't have the stuff to be a closer anymore. And he goes, and he's basically the best closer in the National League for 3.5 years at 35, 36, 37 years old. I mean, what do you think the mindset was when Bobby Cox, Hall of Fame manager, comes in and says, look, buddy, you just killed it for a decade for us, but we're going to move you to the back end of the bullpen. I mean, I think I'd have a little ego check there.
I've never pitched out of the bullpen in my whole life. Even as a kid, I never pitched in relief. So to be able to be elite at your craft and then just out of nowhere switch routines, I mean, you know the routine. You've done both, but like, the routine is so different. Yeah, that's impressive to me. I know some starters that go to the bullpen and just can't do it. They can't do the not knowing when they're going to be up. They're panicky and fidgety all game, moving around. So not just to become a reliever, but to be an elite reliever, that's super impressive.
To touch on what you just brought up, I think closing is the way to go, because you still have a pretty good idea when you're going to throw.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
and you can get into a really good routine. Like the seventh, you get up and you start moving around. The eighth, you probably like really move around, get hot, and then obviously you're getting everything ready to go in for the ninth. So that helps on the mental side of stuff, as opposed to just, oh, the phone rang in the fifth inning, John Smoltz, get up. Like, oh, let me get this 37-year-old body moving around real quick. I agree. I think it's very impressive. And just now that I've heard him talk and heard him in the broadcast booth and stuff, I think that you could tell why he could handle that. He's just smart. He's very articulate when he talks pitching. And you could just tell, like, when the ball was in his hand, he knew what he wanted to do. And he was just going to go out there and get outs and do his job. and then to go back to starting at age 38 and throw 200 innings at 41 or whatever it is I said. I mean, he was just put on earth to pitch. He was smart. He had the arsenal. Just impressive, man. Let's finish with the postseason success. So a lot of this I wrote under kind of a bold note of mindsets, like the different mindsets that he had to have during his career as far as like getting moved from starting to relieving, competing with his teammates for Cy Youngs, which we touched on. You know, how do you keep up with Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine? Well, I got to go out there. I got to take the ball every fifth day and I got to pitch really well. And that they both basically all three of them spent 15 plus years with the same organization, having one pitching coach and all that, like all this stuff. He was really mentally strong. You can just tell. And then the postseason is where you can really tell that when it matters the most. Touched on it earlier, second all time in wins, fourth in win percentage, I guess third in innings pitched, second in strikeouts now since Kirsch passed him, or maybe third in strikeouts now. I think Verlander passed him too. 41 games, 15-4 record, four saves, 200 plus innings, 200 strikeouts, a 2.6.
That's an
ERA.
Elite full season right there.
Yeah, it is. And he did it, you know, that's not just a couple postseasons. That's 15 straight postseasons, whatever it was. So every time he took the ball in October, he did well. That's where, as a teammate of Clayton Kershaw for 5 years, like if you're going to poke at him, that's where people do it. And I hate it for him because he's got plenty of outings where he went 7 innings, 1 run. He just also has outings where he went 4 innings, 5 runs. And that, you know, brings up the ERA, all that stuff. And those are in big moments. So people remember him. When you think of John Smoltz pitching the postseason, what do you think brought him to that next level every time? It just has to be mentally just strong.
It's crazy. This is random, but I feel like I have to say it. My coming to the big leagues moment when I was like starstruck for the first time was we went to Turner Field in 2016 and seeing the like 15 consecutive NL East division pennants up there was mind blowing to me. I knew the Braves were a good team and I knew they were a dynasty in the 90s, early 2000s, but seeing that they went to the playoffs for like 15 consecutive years was absolutely insane for me to see.
The Dodgers are at 8 right now. Yeah. And it feels like it's a lifetime for probably any NL West fan that's not a Dodger fan. You're like, God, get anyone besides the Dodgers in there. And they're halfway. They're halfway to 15.
Yeah,
I mean, it's crazy.
8's really incredible. So just the expectation that they were going to be in the playoffs. They knew going into the season, like, we're going to be in the playoffs. And I feel like maybe that played into their mindset of like, yes, regular season success matters. And they're competitive. And they want to win and go out there and do their thing. But they all knew they were preparing for the postseason. And I feel like that's, you know, what Smoltz knew going into a year. He's like, I'm going to get my work in. I'm going to go, you know, obviously dominate for a season, but I'm going to be ready for the playoffs when it comes time. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole season of innings and starts. That's just really incredible. Again, as a guy who's never been to the playoffs, like that doesn't even really register with me.
I think a lot of it is stuff that we've touched on before, is the idea that Maddux probably took the ball in game one. Then you probably went the lefty Glavine in game two. My guess is they did well. And it's like, all right, Smoltz in game three, a Cy Young winner, but a guy that's trying to keep up with what those two guys just did on the nights before him and pass the baton, like you said. I mean, it's just, they all probably built off each other and wanted to have success, wanted to be better than the other one, pitch better, go longer into the game, whatever. And I think to have the success that you have in the big leagues, you have to be a competitive dude. But to keep up with the Maddux and the Glavines of the world, you have to be a crazy competitive dude. And I think that, you know, obviously we've talked about the stuff and how good it was, but then to have that just like flip a switch and I'm gonna go out there and eat people for lunch, I think that's probably what John Smoltz did. All right, the last question we finish with every podcast, and you know, he's a fairly modern pitcher, obviously pitching in the 2000s, so a lot of times this question's pretty easy with a guy that you've seen somewhat recently. But how would he be in today's game, 2020, 2021 baseball? How would John Smoltz be?
So I'm looking at his numbers here of his pitch arsenal and his velo and stuff. Just his pitch mix alone makes me think he could fare well in today's game. He threw a lot of four-seamers, not a ton of sinkers. He threw his breaking ball a lot, and then he had a splitty. So he seemed maybe a little ahead of his time with the pitch usage. I think that would put him already in good company. And then he, you know, above average fastball velocity. I think he would do well. And then if you put, I think you wrote it down under it. Yeah. Given the amount of information we have, you've mentioned like he's a really smart dude. He seems like he really knows what he's talking about. You couple in his stuff with today's analytics and the information available, and then the experience he had from a full career, I think he would do really well.
Yeah. Spot on is what I wrote down. I mean, you listen to how smart he is at pitching. So for one, he can navigate through the game himself with feel in command, but then now he's going to get all the information that we get from bats and true media about these guys' weaknesses, can pitch to his strengths and to their weaknesses. And now you also going to have some, you know, Harvard graduate up above moving the defense around behind him. So guys like Tony Gwynn can't just slap a ball in the four hole, six hole, whatever, you know, they're going to shade those guys. And like you said, I mean, he was throwing 94, 95, like stuff that's very normal in today's game. I think he would be just as good today, if not better, than he was during his career, which is a crazy thing to think of. I mean, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah, being able to manipulate that slider too, give him different looks, I think that would go a long way. Getting through the order third time. I didn't even think about the shifting thing, but yeah, I mean, imagine you put a shift behind a guy who's got that kind of command and that information available. I think he would do really well.
All right, JMO, that's all we got, man. That's John Smoltz. Hope you guys learned some stuff. You know, hope you came in maybe not really knowing that much about John Smoltz, and now you understand why he's in the Hall of Fame and why JMO wanted to talk about him today. That was a fun one. Always fun to talk pitching, especially with the current big leaguer. JMO, good luck on the rest of rehab. Looking forward to seeing you on the mound in 2021. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks for talking.